Well, good evening, all. If you're current on your daily Bible reading, we've read one of the best-known stories in the whole Old Testament. It's that story of the golden calf back in Exodus 32. Why don't you go ahead and turn with me to Exodus 32, and we're going to talk about that. You know, one of the problems when we approach these stories that are so familiar to us, whether it's Noah or whether it's Jonah or whether it's the golden calf or any of the other really familiar, David and Goliath, really familiar stories of the Old Testament, they're so familiar to us that we can get bored by the story, and then we lose focus and don't even pay attention to what's going on. So we need to take a look at the story again. It all starts with Moses on Mount Sinai. He's been up there for just under 6 weeks, 40 days and 40 nights is what we're told. People at the base of the mountain get restless and anxious. Let's start in verse 1, read the first 6 verses of Exodus 32. Just kind of visualize this scene, if you will. Moses has been gone almost 6 weeks. And so it says, when the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, come, make us gods who will go before us. Now just think about that. If you're Aaron, it's going to be a very intimidating scene. You got all these people thronging around you, and you have nowhere to turn that someone's not staring at you. So you got all these people thronging around him, and they're saying, come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses, who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him. That phrase, this fellow, that is really interesting because it only occurs 8 times in the whole Old Testament. This fellow. And every time it occurs, it's an expression of contempt. And so what they're saying is, hey, you know, this guy Moses, whoever he is, I mean, we don't know what happened to him. He's gone. We need to take some action here, get something done. And of course, they're talking to Moses' brother. He's not just this fellow. They're talking to Moses' brother. Verse 2, Aaron answered them, take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me. So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord. So the next day the people rose early, sacrificed burnt offerings, and presented fellowship offerings. Afterward they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. And the indulge in revelry thing here is it's a pretty unmistakable term for sexual immorality. So they're just completely out of control here. Anytime we come to a story like this, the challenge is always to see what God is doing, because the Bible is about God. It's not about us. So the question is, what is God doing in this? Here in the rest of this story, from that point on, I think God is using this as kind of a teachable moment. You know what a teachable moment is? That's when somebody does something really dumb, and you can drive home a powerful lesson to them that they'll probably hang on to and remember after that. So God is going to use this as a teachable moment to drive home 4 really timeless truths to the Israelites, and you know, and us too, if we'll just pay attention. So the first truth that he's going to drive home to them is, there is only one God, and there are no idols at all. Okay, there is only one God, and there are no idols at all. Look at verse 8. Well, look at verse 7. Then the Lord said to Moses, go down, because your people whom you brought up out of Egypt have become corrupt. They've been quick to turn away from what I commanded them and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They've bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and have said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. Now, what's happened here is these Israelites have come out of Egyptian bondage. They grew up down in Egypt. That's all they've ever known. And the culture in Egypt was covered up in idols. They had a ton of gods. I have no idea how many they had in Egypt, but they had a bunch of them. They had the Nile was a god. It was the source of life. The sun was a god. That was the source of warmth and energy. There was a god named Osiris, who was the god of government. He kept things in good order. There was Isis. Isis was the goddess of fertility. They had all these different gods. And they learned to assign the blessings that they received to all these gods. You know, you got food to eat, well, that comes from the Nile. You got energy and warmth, well, the fire comes from the sun. You know, whatever it is, the great blessing, whatever they're accepting, it's got to be the result of some god. Oh, the big, most popular god in Egypt, by the way, was Apis, the bull. He's the source of power and strength, and everybody wants power and strength, right? And that's probably why, when they thought about making a god, the first thing that came to their mind was a calf, you know, a bull, something like that, because that's the source of power and strength. That's what their culture had taught them. The thing about it is, when they were brought out of Egypt in the Exodus, they were supposed to be converted in their minds from that culture. They're supposed to be changed. Not buying into that culture, but being different from that culture. That was what God wanted. But these people were thinking that whatever the source of their blessings was, it was something other than God. And you think, I'm glad we don't live like that now. Well, I don't know. Let's think about it a little bit. What is the source of the various blessings that we have? What is the source of health? For example, here in America, we're real big on health, saw a deal. Surgeon General's real big on smoking and obesity now. I mean, because those are the two preventable health problems. So we're big on health. What's the source of our health? Most people would say medicine. Medicine is the source of our health. The medical profession is very powerful, and doctors are kind of the high priests of the medicine idol. Okay, well, you want to look at it that way, maybe so. So what is the source of our security? Where does our security come from? Well, it comes from government. The government provides our security. You know, they provide our social security for one thing, and they provide our defense, and they provide the infrastructure for us. So all of our security is tied up in government. So the government is the source of our blessings. What's the source of our what's the source of power? Well, the God money. Always has been, right? The God money provides us our strength, our power, and oddly enough, we have an awful lot of people out here in the world who assign their blessings to everyone except God, and they see that the source of all their blessings comes from someplace other than God. We're supposed to be converted in our thinking. We're supposed to be changed in the way we think. No, we don't find security in the government. Now, the government does not provide security. Our God provides security. Power does not come from money. It comes from our God. If we have any kind of success in this world, it comes from the hand of God. Where does health come from? Well, it doesn't come from the medical profession, and if you talk to doctors seriously about this, they'd be the first to tell you they don't create health. They try to help it as much as they can, but health is always a blessing from God and no place else. God is the source of all of our blessings. We need to be converted in our own minds, because all these things, medicine, government, money, none of those things are evil. They're all good, but they're all created things. They are not gods. And we need to be very careful to understand this same lesson that God is driving home to these people. There is one God. He's the source of all blessings. God is the source of all blessings. And there's no idol at all. And the second lesson is a little harder to take, actually. The second lesson is you are not in charge. Go back to verse 7 again. Take a look at that. There's a real interesting interplay that goes on between God and Moses here. Because God comes to speak to Moses about this. In verse 7 he says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, go down because your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt." You skip down to verse 11. "Moses sought the favor of the Lord his God. O Lord," he said, "why should your anger burn against your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand?" Does this remind you of when you were a kid and you got in trouble? And your mom went to your dad and said, "Do you know what your kid did?" Like, not my kid. You know what your kid did? Here's Moses. God comes to Moses and says, "These are your people." Moses says, "They're not my people. They're your people. You're the one who brought them up out of Egypt." See, God is really in charge, the people thought that they were in charge. They thought they were in charge. They thought it was all up to them. So they assumed that they could determine what worship would be. What does it say back up there in the first few verses? Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord. They determined that the idol is the God that brought them up out of Egypt. So Aaron decides that tomorrow there's going to be a festival, and the people got up early, and what did they do? Well, they sacrificed burnt offerings, they declared a festival, set up the altar. They just went crazy there. They thought they were in charge. Skip down to verse 26. You know, as this is all blowing up here, in verse 26, Moses is being talked about in verse 26. So he stood at the entrance to the camp and he said, "Whoever is for the Lord, come to me." And all the Levites rallied to him. All of you who have understood that God is in charge here, come to me. And they do. Whoever is for the Lord. Now, if you're for yourself, you just go ahead and stay out there. But if you're for the Lord, you come to me. And all the Levites rallied to Moses. We got the same kind of problem today. People think they're in charge in the religious world. They think they determine what worship is going to be and what and how it's going to work, and they just make this stuff up for themselves. Whatever pleases them. Things that God has never commanded, festivals that God has never commanded. They observe special days. They observe all kinds of special rituals, incorporate things into worship that God never asked for or demanded. They just decide they're going to make it up for themselves. And where do we find this? Over and over and over. You know, we are most distinctively noted for our singing without instruments. The only thing I want to say about that is the history of the Lord's church. We have always, from apostolic days, we have always sung hymns, spiritual songs and so on to God, without the use of instruments. Instruments have been brought in just in the last few hundred years. For more than 1,000 years before that, it was never a part of Christian worship. So how did we wind up with it? If it was never part of Christian worship, how did we wind up with it? And the answer is, well, that's what they wanted to do. People decided they were in charge, could do it any way they wanted to. Same thing with the Lord's Supper. We participate in the Lord's Supper every first day of the week, just like they did in the New Testament. Well, why do some groups do it once a month or once a quarter or just on two or three special days a year? And why do some groups do it every day and some groups do it on a day other than Sunday? I mean, why do they decide to do that? And the answer is because that's what they decided to do. They're going to make these things up for themselves because that's what they want to do. They think they're in charge. The bottom line on that is we need to submit to God. As followers of Jesus Christ, we need to submit to God. I phrase it like this. We need to get on the team. You know, the team is not going to do well unless all the team members buy into the game plan and decide that they're going to do things the same way the coach wants it done. That the team is never going to do well until they acknowledge one source of authority. We need to do the same thing. We need to get on the team. We need to submit to God's will and do what He'd have us to do. The agenda in the church is not the preacher's agenda. It's not the elder's agenda. It's not some dominant member's agenda who swings a big checkbook. There are churches who fall into all those problems. But the agenda is not driven by the preacher or the elders or some other member. It's driven by God. The agenda is God's agenda. And that's the bottom line. Our responsibility is to get on the team. Okay. Enough about that. Third lesson I think that God drives home in this is over in verse 25. In verse 25, what the lesson that God drives home is, you Israelites were not freed in order to please yourselves. Look at verse 25. Moses saw that the people were running wild and that Aaron had let them get out of control and so become a laughingstock to their enemies. People have just gone crazy. They're doing whatever they wanted to do. And basically, the attitude that the Israelites had was that freedom from their Egyptian bondage was something that was owed to them. That was a proper payment for all the time that they had spent in slavery. And all their hard service and bondage, they were entitled to freedom now. And since they had been freed from all that, they were now free. And that means free to do whatever they want. It was what they deserved, you see. They were owed that freedom, so they could chase off and do anything that they wanted to. They didn't have any sense of restraint. They didn't have any sense of obligation toward God for freeing them from that and redeeming them, bringing them out. They thought it was all about them. They thought God freed them because they had it coming. They did not understand that God freed them because He had a big plan for them. They thought they were the goal of the plan. And they're barely an intermediate step in God's plan. They thought it was all about them. And it wasn't about them. I think that something like that happens to people today, too. They think that grace, the grace of God, is something that they deserve. It's only right and proper because they're such wonderful, lovable, terrific people that it only makes sense that God would redeem them and bring them out and free them. One guy put it like this. He said, most people see sin as a bunch of thou shalt not rules that they need to be freed from. See, they don't think that there's anything wrong with it. They need to be freed from all these arbitrary rules that God has made up. They think that grace is something that's owed to them. They have no sense of obligation toward God for freeing them from sin. They have no sense of obligation toward others and no idea that the plan is way, way, way bigger than them. They think that they are the goal. But, you know, they're the whole reason that Jesus came. They're the whole reason that He lived among us and died on the cross, just so that person personally could be saved. And with that, the plan of God is complete and everything's good. But the reality is, God has work for us to do. It isn't about us. God's plan is not about us. He's got lots bigger plans than just me. I may be an important part of His plan, but He's got work for us to do. We weren't redeemed from sin and death so that we could just go out and play. You know, the bottom line, we were not redeemed just so that we could go out and play. We were redeemed because God has a purpose for His people. Last lesson, fourth lesson here is down in verse 33. Skip all the way down to the end. Verse 33 down through verse 35. Last couple of verses here. The Lord replied to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. Now go, lead the people to the place I spoke of. My angel will go before you. However, when the time comes for me to punish, I will punish them for their sin." And the Lord struck the people with a plague because of what they did with the calf Aaron made. See, here's the lesson. Except for grace, you reap what you sow. If it's not for the grace of God, you reap what you sow. These people deserve death. What they had done to sin against God, to break the covenant that they had already agreed to, that earned death. But God suspended justice from them in favor of grace. He did not wipe them out. Didn't kill them instantly like they deserved. Now, he did do something that kind of scared them, really terrified Moses. He offered to let them go on without him. I want you to think about that just for a second. What these people have done is they have turned away from God. They have turned away from the covenant. They've decided to build themselves an idol and to declare, this is your God, O Israel. And so God says, you know what? If that's the way you want it, fine. You can go on without me. And Moses said, oh no, if you're not going, we're not going. We're not doing anything without you. Because Moses was smart enough, he understood, they couldn't have done anything that they had done without the presence of God. What God offered the people was, you can reap what you have sown. And Moses said, no, we want grace. We do not want justice here. It's still true, I think, that except for grace, we reap what we sow. The concept of karma comes up over and over and over. All man-made religions have some element of this in it. Karma. That's you get what you deserve. What goes around comes around. You can, you know, however you want to explain it. You know, payback stinks. You know, however you want to explain it. The idea that what you do rebounds to you comes up over and over and over and over again because that's what people observe in the world. You just look out there and you see this happen over and over and over. People do bad things and bad things happen to them. People do good things and good things happen to them. What's unique to God is the concept of grace, that you do bad things and the bad thing doesn't come back to kill you because God offers grace. The man-made religions don't act that way. There's never a concept of grace there. But God offers grace. And we don't want any justice in our lives. You know, like I was talking about this morning, we want God to remember every good deed that we've done. We don't want Him to remember any of the bad stuff that we've done. We want grace. I think this is what God is doing in this whole story. The story of the golden calf is not really a story about the Israelites. It's a story about God and His compassion and long-suffering toward these people. He uses the incident to drive home some lessons, and I think it's worth being reminded what these lessons are. I think it's also worth being reminded we need to take a look at our most familiar Bible stories and see what it is that God is doing in there. What is God doing with Jonah? What is God doing with Noah? You know, what is God doing with David in taking out Goliath? Christ came and lived among us and died as a sacrifice to redeem us from sin and set us free from the law of sin and death. That's our Exodus event. He releases us from bondage and brings us out, but He didn't set us free so that we could make ourselves comfortable and amused. That is not the purpose of our redemption, so that we can be comfortable and amused. He set us free to be His people, to live in submission to Him, to fulfill His agenda. I mean, He is the source of all of our blessings. We don't get it from medicine or money or government or anywhere else. God is the source of all of our blessings. He's the author of grace to us. He's the Lord of our lives. And the bottom line is, it's time for us to get on the team. We're going to sing an invitation song. If you're not a Christian, you can obey the gospel of Christ. I mean, Christ has offered us redemption, freedom from sin and death. And you can do what all the New Testament Christians did. You can, because of your faith in Jesus, you can confess His name, repent of sin, be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins, and raised to a new life with Him. If you're a Christian, though, and you've made the covenant with Christ in the past, and it never really occurred to you that you were redeemed and freed for a big, big purpose and not just for your own amusement, maybe you really haven't been on the Lord's team and you need to think seriously about what you're called to be and do. Maybe you need to repent. We're going to sing an invitation song, and if there's anything that you need to do in a public way, we'd love to help you with that because we really want you on the team that's the winning team. If you need to respond publicly to Jesus' invitation, we urge you to do it right now. While we stand together and sing.